Faith, give me a little 1-2.
1-2.
4-3-4-5-6. Check.
Well, I don't usually run with a pack, but I usually have a little Girl Scout runner friend with me that will bring... Seriously, she calls herself...
A Girl Scout?
I actually I rent a Girl Scout, child labor, and I make them mule my teepee.
I think we may have talked about this before, but I don't use teepee anymore.
Well, we talked about it, Scott.
Yeah.
Welcome to Trail Runner Nation, and we're building a nutrition sandwich today. We're bringing two podcasts and making them into one. Isn't that what we're doing, Scott?
It is.
And when we're talking nutrition, who do we think about when we're at Trail Runner Nation?
You know, before I even finish the word nutrition, when I go I just think Sonny Blundell. I don't even finish the word.
All right.
In fact, some people think when I start talking about, I just start saying, well, my Sonny plan is, it's not my nutrition plan, it's my Sonny plan.
Oh, is that what you do?
Yeah, it is.
Huh. I hadn't caught on to that.
So what we're talking about today, we're going to be talking about metabolic efficiency training. And it all kind of didn't start with Bob Siebehar, but because this was studies that have gone back into the 30s with metabolic efficiency training. But Bob Siebehar wrote a book on metabolic efficiency training not too long ago. And this podcast is an interview with Tim Fleming, who is an expert on metabolic efficiency training. And then we decided to get Sonny Blundell on to add some of her experiences and some of her thoughts about metabolic efficiency training. And then we're going to edit both these podcasts together to make one fine. It's kind of like, do you remember the commercials? You got my chocolate and my peanut butter.
Yeah.
No, you got your peanut butter on my chocolate. That's what this is. It's it's the Rhesus podcast.
We're an edit-free podcast, Scott Ware, aren't we?
No. So, Sonny,
can I be the chocolate?
Yeah, that's right. You're the M&M queen, aren't you?
I am.
Sonny, thank you for joining us. She's enjoying the nice, brilliant, beautiful outdoors of Idaho right now. Mm. Coming to us from Idaho. But thank you for joining us, Sonny.
All right, I'm happy to be here. Yeah, I am enjoying some beautiful weather. Some outdoor hill running in northern Idaho, and some swimming and rowing and biking and stand-up paddleboarding and you name it.
That's great.
Stand-up paddleboarding. Now you've caught my attention. I've done a little of that, and only a little, but I want to do a whole lot more. You know, stand-up paddleboarding, tell me if you can identify with this, Sonny. If there isn't anything better to help with your balance and core strengthening, because everything that goes through that paddle has to come up through your feet and has to go through that core, and I find that to be a great workout.
It is a great workout, especially if you work hard at it. I think rowing is a better workout, but it takes a shell, a place, a lot of learning curve, and stand-up paddleboarding, you can jump on and have a good time from day one.
Well, I've seen Scott jump up and jump on, and he had a pair of sunglasses that only lasted about a minute and a half.
Brand new pair of sunglasses went to the bottom of the lake. I hadn't even put them on my face. They were on my head.
I was going to mention that, but I didn't want to sound like a mother hen. You know, I said, Scott, those are new glasses. Maybe you want to leave them back in the truck. I thought, no, I'm just going to be, I trust Scott. You know, he's a balance. He's good with balance. He was a skier.
Don's got my back. Anyway,
all
Sonny,
right.
let's talk about metabolic efficiency training. Tell us about your experience with metabolic efficiency training. You have some hands-on, first-person experience, right?
I do. I started putting some of my clients on this, and it was working well, and I thought I really should try it myself. You know, I need to know what I'm telling my clients to do. So I met with Tim Fleming at Endurance in Mill Valley, and was tested on a metabolic cart to find out where my crossover point is, where I went out and started running slow, then got faster and faster, and where I stopped burning a lot of fat and started burning mostly carbs. And since I am a very good nutritionist and I eat every 20 minutes and I take in my 200 to 300 calories an hour, I was pretty carb dependent. So that's fine as long as you have carbs all the time. However, when the runs get longer and longer, it gets harder and harder to keep getting those carbs in, as we all know. We can sometimes have stomach problems. So I decided, all right, I'm going to go on this diet, even though I had to take away my chips, which are my favorite afternoon snack. So I went on this for 8 weeks. And during those 8 weeks, my nutrition changed the most. It was about 70% diet, 30% exercise. So I found out my crossover point. My crossover point was about at a heart rate of 134 beats. So that means anything I did up to 134 beats, I was pretty much burning fat mostly. When I crossed over, then I was starting to burn carbs. So, and also I started out at 17% body fat. I went on this for 8 weeks. I was really good on nutrition. And on the exercise, I'd say out of 7 days a week, one day a week, I just did whatever I wanted without my heart rate monitor. And the other six, I really stayed in the heart rate zone, which meant that on a 10-mile run, it might take me 2 hours, 45 minutes, because when I got to the hills, I had to walk up them in order to keep my heart rate down.
And that heart rate that you were trying to stay under was that 135 beats, that crossover point. You were trying to stay under the crossover point, right?
Stay under the crossover point.
Okay.
I did not take a lot of nutrition at all. In fact, during those times, I usually started with taking some UCAN before I left my house, and then I just had water and electrolytes. So that's all I did, even if I was on a four-hour run. So I did that. I cut out my interval training. I did very little hill repeats except walking up the hills. Did that for 8 weeks. And at the end of 8 weeks, I lost 4 pounds of body fat. I gained 2 pounds of body muscle. I went from 17% body fat to 14% body fat. This is in 8 weeks. I didn't think it was possible. And my crossover point went from 134 to 148.
That's the amazing thing right there.
Well, I think all of those are amazing.
Amazing, because in that 8 weeks, 6 weeks out was the Catalina Trail Marathon down in Southern California that I'd signed up for. And I asked him, I said, you think I can do this? And he goes, sure, just use it as a training run. So what I did with that is 3 days before the marathon, I went back to eating some carbs, some grain carbs, which I'd cut out before. And the night before, I didn't carb a lot, but I definitely had a good dinner that had some grain carbs in it. Then I started the run, and for the first 3 hours, I just took UCAN or water and electrolytes. I didn't take anything. And then after 3 hours, I took, I think, 2 or 3 gels in the next hour and a half. And I did really well. I did faster than I ran it 5 years ago. I won my age group. I would have placed in 2 age groups below. It was 10 minutes faster than my girlfriend that usually beats me. And I thought, this is great. And then I ate the post, you know, race meal with some carbohydrates. Then I went right back into the metabolic efficiency for the next 2 weeks.
Now, what you said you were taking the UCAN. Can you explain to us what's in the UCAN? What
UCAN is a low glycemic index product. So it is something that doesn't spike your blood sugar at all. You can't spike your blood sugar when you're on this metabolic diet, because the minute you give your body some carbs, some high sugar, your body would prefer to use carbs than fat, and it'll turn off the fat burning and use the carbs.
That's the training. Is this any, you know, and forgive me for just be, you know, asking this question, maybe I'm, but somebody else out there might have this question. Is this anything like the Atkins diet, where you're higher with the fat intake and lower on the carbs?
A little, but you are lower on calories than an Atkins diet. Okay, you do not eat less calories on this diet. That's where everybody tends to, you know, take a wrong step, including me, because I started cutting out my greens and I wasn't really adding anything. And then I needed to add a bit more protein, and I needed to add more vegetables and fruits, definitely. So they needed to take up the space. But you can't just add a ton more vegetables and fruits because it fills you up. So you definitely need to add some more protein, like yogurt and nuts and cottage cheese, things like that, and not necessarily fat-free yogurt. Because if you have fat-free yogurt, then you're taking out one of the other macronutrients that you want to have. So you want some carbohydrates, you want some fat, you want some protein.
So Sunny, give us an idea, an example of what your diet was before you started this plan and what it was while you were on this plan. What were you eating before, and then what did you cut out and what did you add while you were on the diet?
Okay, breakfast, I used to eat oatmeal a lot, or maybe some green cereals with a lot of nuts or berries on them like that. And what I went to was eating Greek yogurt with berries and some nuts. I'd have that for breakfast. Or I would have about a quarter cup black beans, a whole lot of frozen spinach, and some egg whites on it, put it in the microwave for 4 minutes, and I had this great little omelet. And it was good and kept me not being hungry till noon, even though I really think you should eat every 2 hours. It was great. It really kept my blood sugar very steady.
Do you have to, can you keep the yolks in those eggs, or is that just
sure
a personal choice? Okay.
Yeah, sure you can. I just used the egg whites because it was easy. And I'll put turmeric in it because I have a good use for turmeric, which really is like CoQ enzyme 10, and it's more natural, and it's a great antioxidant. I just don't cook Indian very often, so here was a place I could throw it in. You could also put salt on this. I put feta cheese on sometimes. So that was my breakfast a lot, and I still eat that for breakfast because I liked it so much. Lunches went from sandwiches or something that would have a pita bread or a quesadilla or something like that. Went to salads with a protein source on top. So when I was cooking chicken or fish or something like that, I tend to cook a little bit more so I had a piece left over that I could put on my salad, or tofu.
Okay.
So that's where my lunch went. My afternoon snacks, where I was also sending Tim my pictures of my chips with my I hate you emails, I had to cut those out. So I went and I had different kinds of dips. So I had a yogurt spinach kale dip, or I had hummus, and I got the cut up fruits and vegetables, you know, carrots and green beans and radishes and celery and jicama and all that stuff. So that's what I'd have in the afternoon. For dinner, I'd still have my protein source. I'd have a big bunch of vegetables like I usually do, and then I'd have a second kind of vegetables because I started just cutting out those greens. And I realized my dinner just didn't have very many calories in it anymore. So I probably ate a little bit more protein, a little bit bigger piece of protein, whether it's, you know, salmon or chicken or, you know, a bean stew or something like that, and a couple sources of vegetables and a big salad. And for dessert, I usually would have a little bite of chocolate, like 85% chocolate, you know, really dark chocolate. And that was it. And one thing I didn't do is I didn't cut out my wine, and I still got this result.
There you go. And when I go 85%, that means I've eaten at least 85% of the bar, of the chocolate bar. Now, where can you find, or can you direct us to some type of diet or menu? Is there something like that online, or a book or something, so that if people have written...
Go to Bob Siebelhaar's site, because Bob Siebelhaar has a couple things. He has not only his metabolic efficiency training book, but he has another kind of handout book that has, it goes by numbers. So it tells you just, you know, how to put together a meal with numbers. And then there's another one that I have, has nutrition and recipes on it. I don't think you really need the nutrition and recipes. If you like to cook, you would. I'm really not a chef. I'm a nutritionist. So I eat the food and I eat it pretty close to the source. So I didn't need a lot of that, but, it becomes pretty easy. At first you think, what am I going to eat? But actually, you know, when you start eating like this, you're full a lot. It's you don't have those up and down spikes. And one thing I did add a lot of is nuts. So the nuts brought the calories up.
Let's talk about the crossover point, because that's a pretty, you know, important piece of this equation. And you referenced where you started and watched it and used it as a tool to see if you've made some gains. How do you find this crossover point? And when we talk to Tim, he has a formula. What do you recommend?
Well, if you can afford it, or there's a metabolic cart, you know, at the university sports science department, great, do that. But you don't have to do that. I think you can do two different things. I think you're going to have to figure out your maximum heart rate. So there's a lot, you know, get on the internet and figure it out as best you can with a heart rate monitor. Then take 60% of that. Then also take 180 minus your age, which is Tim's formula. Find out where those two numbers are. Make that your range, if there's a little bit of a range between the two. Mine were very similar. So start there. Here's the thing. You can actually figure out your crossover point just by going out and running at whatever speed. Start out slow. And if you are running on nothing, if you're only taking in water and electrolytes, and you're not taking in calories and or not taking in carbs, and you haven't been eating carbs, if you get out of your crossover point, you're going to bonk. You're going to feel it. You went too fast because your body is now stopped burning fat and you don't have any carbs to burn, or very few. So all the time when I talk on your podcast about taking in so many carbs and taking in so many carbs, it's great, especially in a race, because you can do it because there's all those aid stations. But the rest of the time, as we all know, we go out on a training run, we don't take enough stuff, you know, and we get lows in that. Well, that's because we're burning carbs. But if you train your fat burning, if you take away the carbs, your body still has this, you know, survival mechanism that, you know, you're running away from the lion and you're running through all your carbs. But when you get through the carbs, you still are running away from the lion. It's just not such a pretty picture. It's a bonking. So you can feel that. So then you can start to narrow in on what actually is your crossover point. You can always go lower.
So when you're out there training, what did you find, like, if we could just speak in what you feel, how much did you back off your training intensity? Was it a great amount, or you know, just kind of give us an idea of what we might be looking towards, if that makes any sense?
That was interesting. When I was running by myself, I definitely had to back off. But if I was running with my girlfriends and chatting away, I was surprised at how much of the time I wasn't that fat burning. You know, if you start talking and getting sidetracked or not paying much attention, you'll probably slow down. Just fat burning feels good.
And, you know, we've talked about running economy with Dr. Cucuzella, and I was on a trail run the other day, and we were just talking about that very topic, running economy. And what pace do we run, or where are we at when we're most efficient with our body and our body mechanics, and how long can we last at a certain pace, and what is that sweet spot? And I'll bet you all those lines intersect right at the crossover point, right where our musculoskeletal system for ourselves, our cardiovascular, VO2 max, all that stuff, all that probably crosses over at that very point that you're talking about, Sunny.
It does. And the problem is a lot of us, even though we've been running for years and years, don't have very good running economy. That's how I started this whole thing. I was tested at the other end of the scale, you know, the maximum heart rate, VO2 max, and all that stuff down at Stanford Human Performance Lab. And what they told me is my good nutrition made up for my poor running economy.
Wow.
You know, I wasn't very economical. I actually needed to go faster in order to feel good, but I had to keep the carbs coming in.
Interesting. So
it does all cross over, but the more fat you can burn, the better you are going to be, because you don't need to take anything in, therefore you just eliminated all the stomach problems, or you don't need to take in very much. And you've got plenty of fat. No matter how lean you are, you can run, if you're 6% body fat, you could run 25 marathons back to back.
Sunny, are you suggesting that we, if we trained ourselves properly in this way, that we could run past some aid stations, certainly not with the fluids, but would you say that if we learned how to burn our fat, we wouldn't be dependent on these aid stations at 6 and 8 mile intervals?
I ran past several at the Catalina Marathon, and I ran past several at a 50K just not too long ago. Yes, that's what I'm saying. And especially in training, so think about this. You're going to be training in this level. No, you will not get slower and slower and slower. So most people think, I don't want to go in that because I'm going to lose all my speed. Well, you're not going in it forever. You're going in it for 6 or 8 weeks. So you're not going to lose all your speed. But your running economy will get so much better. Your body fat will lower. So now, even if you don't lose any weight, you're going to change some of your body fat into lean muscle. Now you've got a bigger engine to run with. So now, during a race, you don't need your carbs so soon, but when you do get the carbs, you can speed up. You will go faster. And I think that's what Tim talks about when he says one day a week you can do something else, or if you go on a really long run and you're in your metabolic efficiency training for 2 hours and then you go out of it, if you're going to go faster, like say you're going to run a couple hours by yourself and you're going to meet your friends for another 2 hours and you're going to go out of it, then you need to start taking in the carbs when you're out of that zone, so you don't bonk, because you don't want to bonk, and if you bonk, you just burn up your muscle. So you go out of that zone, you take in your carbs, your gels, your things that we're used to, you finish your run, then you do your 30-minute window, because now you've depleted your carb stores, so you take something in afterwards, and then you go right back on the metabolic efficiency training. When you stay all in your metabolic efficiency training, and you finish your run, that 30-minute window is not important because you didn't go through your carbs.
You know, this slower training sounds an awful lot like base training, you know, training your aerobic system in at the beginning of the season where you try to build that huge foundation.
And it is. The difference is if we are taking in too many carbs during that, we're not maximizing that fat fuel efficiency. And that's the whole key here is you have enzymes in all your muscle cells that will take the fat, mobilize it, and burn it. And what we want is more of those enzymes. We want more. And the way you train them is to use them. So you start taking away the carbs, taking all those grain carbs away that we normally run on, and you have to make more enzymes. And when you make more enzymes, you don't necessarily lose them. All right, if you went back, you know, and stopped all this, you'll lose some of it, but you won't lose it all. We all come back. Every time we get in shape, it doesn't take as long to get in shape if we've been in shape, right?
Mm-hmm. True. You know, this sounds an awful lot like, and tell me if we had talked about this before on a different podcast, that Mark Lance and Eric Skadden started off running some of their morning runs, and all they would have is a cup of coffee, and intentionally start off with an empty stomach just to train their fat-burning capacity.
Yeah, just to train their fat-burning. And they're probably gifted. Their fat-burning's probably already going, and they're very lean. So the only difference between them and you and I carrying a little bit more fat and being more middle of the packers is when you will be bonking easier. So it's not a good idea for us to get up and run totally on empty. But you don't need much. You don't need much. And you could definitely do that. Not all the time, but some. And depending, you know, if you had a good meal the night before with high fiber, high nutrients, remember that some of that food's still in you. That is your pre-race or pre-run meal.
So after 8 weeks, you know, you've had all these great improvements, and do you just cold turkey go back to your normal diet? Do you ease into a normal diet? Do you alter your everyday diet to kind of a medium or a compromise between the two? How does that work?
If I tell you that you won't want to go back, you won't believe me, because you'll start to think, no, I'm not, I'm going to miss all those things.
I have a bag of chips here, Sonny, I have a bag of chips.
Well, I definitely got my chips back, but not till late in the day and not nearly as much. And what I am very careful with now, because I really learned this while I was doing the training, is to be very careful not to spike your insulin. Spiking your blood sugar, that's the whole problem with obesity, with our diseases, and with our running. That spiking is what makes us go up and down, up and down. So I'm much more careful now. I eat less grain and more vegetables. So my grain and my vegetables have switched on the plate. Instead of half grains. It's now half vegetables and a quarter grains and a quarter protein.
You know, Sunny, you mentioned earlier that you incorporated more vegetables and fruits. Now, fruits are high in sugar. Do fruits spike your insulin, don't they?
Well, that's where the cold climate fruits come in. So when Tim talks about his diet, when Bob Siebelhaar says, we're talking more cold climate because they don't have as much sugar. The bright sun brings out the sugar and changes. That's what makes the grapes get the wine and so on. So instead of having, pineapples and mangoes and papaya, it's more apples and pears and especially berries, lots of berries, which berries to me are great. So that works out well. Grapefruit, as it turns out, works well. I would think a grapefruit is kind of not a cold climate fruit, but that tends to be okay. So I added more vegetables, I think, than fruits, but I definitely added the fruits for the sugar. The more ripe they are, the higher sugar content they are. So my bananas are pretty green.
You know, you also mentioned your protein sources, and I didn't hear you mention red meat. How does red meat fit into this?
Red meat fits in fine. It's whatever, we're not really going whether it's vegetarian, non-vegetarian here, because again, I don't eat a lot of red meat because of the saturated fat. So I don't want the saturated fat in my diet for health reasons. But as far as the metabolic training, that's not a problem. So the fats aren't the problem, it's the carbohydrates. So you could definitely eat that. On the other hand, you don't want to go out and just eat, salami and bacon and all of this because it's not healthy, not because it's going to hurt the metabolic. That's the Atkins diet.
You mean I have to lose my bacon and salami sandwich?
No, you just need it in proportion.
Okay. I've been very interested in this topic ever since you had brought it up to us. And I've gone out and bought the book by Bob Siebelhaar, and I'm going to be reading it over the next week. The one thing that concerns me is I already feel a little guilty when Don and I go for a run because he's a much better athlete, much faster than I am, and he has to slow down to my pace. If I go on this training program, I'm going to have to slow down even more. And I think that's going to be a really tough pill to swallow for me because I don't want to take away Don's training. I guess I'm just going to have to train for 8 weeks on my own.
I will train with you, Scott Moore. Do you mean I get to run a little bit slower?
I cannot believe that you guys are saying this. What do? You go out and you listen to Trail Runner Nation podcast.
That's right.
Well, maybe we'll do. He's been training for AC 100, and as we've gone out on runs, and he's just become gotten in very, very good shape. What I do is I say, okay, go ahead and do this hill repeat three times while I do it once, and I'll meet you at the top. That's how I get through a run with him.
He should be thrown in jail for embellishing this. This lying at that degree should be a criminal offense. Scott Ward, you're a fine runner.
It is a problem. It is a problem. And I think that's why Tim and Bob, too, say one day just go out, leave your heart rate training, monitor at home. Just go out and do it. You're not going to lose it in one day. What you need to do is, they'll say a minimum of 6 hours, and I doubled that, because we're ultra runners. So do your other training and do that, just go out and run with your friends. And then also when they're having a recovery day or something, that's a day that you can run together. But that's the hard part. That is the hard part. So, find somebody else who's going to do it at the same time and hopefully your heart rates are similar.
Maybe I just need to hobble him somehow and put like a string between his legs so he can only do a half a step.
Put a rock on his back.
Let's call back to Unbreakable where they show Jeff Rose up there and he's running with some of the other runners in town. And I think he called the group the Old Geezer Group, or that's what they call themselves. Yep. I mean, Jeff Rose was clearly doing some metabolic lower intensity training and just building that whole system.
Yep.
Right.
So
it doesn't hurt you. It definitely does not hurt you to go slower. It is that metabolic efficiency place. You can always go slower. The problem is, of course, pretty soon you're running, you're 30 to 40 mile running weeks turn into longer than your work weeks.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But we, you know, we measure not distance, but more time. And yep. we've done that just to, for our own egos, right? Because so, if a person asks you at work, how far did you run? And you said 7 miles, and they go, well, I ran 7 miles, but we have hills in our 7 miles. So we just convert right. it and say, well, we ran for 2 hours and, you know, hour and a half. And that gives us a little more protection. So time right. on your feet, right. time on your feet, guys.
Time on your feet. And that's where the metabolic efficiency training does not hurt you. You can be in the middle of your season and go back into it for a couple weeks. So say, you know, you're going to get your base training, you're really going to do it right. Then you're going to go do a 50-mile run. Afterwards, you're going to recover a little bit. Go right back into the metabolic efficiency for a couple weeks. Gives you a little boost again. Then go back into your training and racing again.
That's just what I was going to ask. If once you do like an introductory 6-8 weeks on this, maybe this becomes part of your periodization training where, you know, in the off season or between, you know, if you have a long stretch between races, you may want to, you know, revert back to the metabolic efficiency training for a couple weeks to, you know, tune your engine.
Exactly. And again, you know, the more you do this, the more it becomes yours. That's where the more enzymes you end up, you know, building in your system. You don't just lose them. You know, it takes years to build them up. It would take years of you not doing anything to lose them all. That's the good thing about it. That's why it's not a crash fix. It is actually changing your metabolism in your body, not just changing your calories in, calories out, or your exercise in, exercise out. It's actually changing your body. You will become leaner.
And, you know, taking some time to back off intensity is just good for longevity. It's good for our body. It's our knees, etc.
You'd be surprised. There's birds out there. You know, there's other things out there on the trail.
Yeah. How many times have you run by a structure and go, you know, I've never seen that before? It just because we're so busy, you know, looking down at right in front of us and hammering the trail. So it's good to step back and take a little time.
Well, it is. And it's good to do a check on your diet, too. I think the whole nutrition part of this, really, most of it is the nutrition because you're just changing the macronutrients that your body has to use. But it's a learning tool. You might find a lot of things that you do like about it, and it's a little healthier. I mean, even Tim Noakes, you know, the lore of running, the carbohydrate king, has changed his diet. I just saw a picture of him, big pulling out a plate with a piece of fish and all these vegetables and a salad, not one grain source on it.
Huh. Well, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for us.
Right.
You know, I think this is a great preview for some of the details up and coming with Tim Fleming. You know, if this introduction from Sonny Blunday hasn't piqued your interest and has you leaning towards scraping some of the grains off your plate as you listen to us during lunch, then I don't know what will, because this has certainly enticed me as well. I'm only about 3 or 4 days out from a race. I don't think I have time to do a metabolic efficiency
no.
training cycle, do I? I mean, what do you recommend?
No.
I better just stick with what I have, right? And just go in with
what
I've got.
Stick with what you have right now. Right, right. The carbs will work, and don't forget there's aid stations in the race.
That's right. I'm just going to bring a big backpack with full of fruits and vegetables and carbohydrates and
some jerky,
maybe some corn syrup.
There you go.
And some chips.
All right. Yeah, well, don't forget the chip. All right.
Well, let's have our first podcast sandwich and bring Tim Fleming.
Let's do it. Hey, thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
I'm Faith Goss.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And a few podcasts ago, we had Sonny Blunday, our favorite nutritionist, on the program. And as we were talking throughout the podcast, we stumbled upon a topic called metabolic efficiency training, and it really perked my interest, and we thought, hey, that sounds like a good discussion that we could have on a podcast. And she recommended that we call Tim Fleming, and that's what we did, because we do everything that Sonny Blunday tells us to do.
Well, of course we should.
Because she's Sonny. Mm-hmm. And so we have Tim Fleming on the podcast today. He is an exercise physiologist. He's a level 2 USAC certified coach. You know what USAC is?
it's something of great standing, and it's not easy to get. That's what I know. Oh, cycling.
A cycling coach.
Got it.
So he's a level 2 certified cycling coach. He has over 8 years of age group and master swimming coaching. What else has he done? He's been coaching competitive triathletes, cyclists, and runners at all levels for nearly 12 years. In the last 5 years, he's been coaching with Endurance Performance Training Center. And we'll list their website on the bottom of this podcast. But if you would like to know where that is, if you're just running down the trail and you have a smartphone, I don't know. If you want to know and you can't read, the website is endurancepptc.com. Thank you, Don. That was an echo, wasn't it? Where you can go and see the many different training services that they offer and testing stuff that they have. Thank you for joining us, Tim. Let's get started. What is metabolic efficiency training?
Well, first, I'd like to say thanks for having me. Metabolic efficiency, there are a lot of definitions in terms of metabolic efficiency, but the popular one and what's most common and applicable is metabolic efficiency refers to your balance and your ability to utilize both fat and carbohydrate during both rest and exercise. So good metabolic efficiency, you kind of have a balance of burning both those carbohydrates and fats depending on the demand. So with a lot of the exercise training, a lot of the work that Bob Sibahar has done, especially with his books, he uses that term, again, to kind of improving your fat burning more specifically, which is a good thing for endurance athletes.
Right. And we will list Bob Sibahar, who Tim just mentioned, wrote a book called, what did he call it? It is Metabolic Efficiency Training, Teaching the Body to Burn More Fat. And it's a book that you can buy, I guess, pretty much anywhere you buy books. And we'll list that, a link to that at the bottom of our website or podcast.
So how can we train our bodies? I know personally I'd like to burn more fat. How can I start to train my body to do that during an endurance exercise?
The first step is finding where your body burns the most fat calories. And so you can be somewhat formulaic about it, but it's nice to be able to actually measure it. And you can measure it using something called a metabolic cart. And what a metabolic cart does is it captures your expired air. And through that, it measures the fractions of O2 and CO2. And in short, it can identify how much carbohydrate and fat you're burning at any particular intensity. So, for example, if you were to do a metabolic efficiency test, it would run you through, let's say, it could be as, 30 minutes to up to an hour. Where you increase your work. So if you're doing like a running treadmill test, you might increase your pace by about half a mile per hour every 5 minutes, where you start at almost a walk or a slow jog, and then you increase to what would be something like a moderate intensity. And within that scope, what you'd notice is fat burning starts off, at a pretty moderate rate. And then it starts to pick up as your total caloric expenditure goes up. Mm-hmm. So, if you have a little more fat getting dumped into the tank for combustion, you get, a peak in fat burning. So we call those fat oxidation curves, and it's kind of looks like a parabola where, it's like a dome. It kind of starts off sort of low, it goes up and it peaks, and then it starts to drop back down again. And another way to look at that is your crossover point that, I think Sonny had mentioned, essentially that point where carbohydrate takes over as the dominant fuel source during exercise. Mm-hmm. And so again, if we're looking at that fat burning curve or your crossover point, again, let's say if you start at 4 miles per hour, 4.5, 5, 5.5, let's say at 4.5, you're burning 250 fat cals. At 5, you're burning 300. At 5.5, it might go back down to 260, and then it might drop down to like 180 at 6 mile per hour pace. So at that point, we can say, okay, well, your max fat burning is, between 280 and 350, and your heart rate is between, you know, 130 and 140 beats per minute. This is just totally making up these numbers, but that would essentially allow you to set a training zone where we know we've isolated the intensity where your body selects for mobilizing the most fat to produce energy.
I have a question. Is there some consistency with that? So you take it one day, is it going to look like that the next day or a week later? And I'm not talking about training it to be more efficient, because that's, I think, where you're going. But is there some, if you don't do anything different, is that a number that's a constant?
So if you took the test 3 mm-hmm. weeks in a row on a Tuesday,
but didn't change anything in your training or diet,
would it be the same?
Right. Is that a pretty good constant?
So essentially, if you came in and tested, you did the same old thing you were doing before, and then you came in and tested again 3
right.
weeks later.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it would be the same, and that kind of comes down to the repeatability of the test. So if you look at it scientifically, what you want is good repeatability.
Without taking this test that you're talking about, is there kind of a rule of thumb of at this heart rate you're still burning fat, and at this heart rate, cause, you know, everybody's seen the treadmills that they go to the gym and they see the treadmill and that says,
yeah,
you know, you stay in this aerobic zone and you're going to be burning fat. You go to this one and you're going to be burning carbs.
Right. I think the traditional is you say it's about, you know, 60% of your max heart rate.
Okay.
And max heart rate varies, depends on the formula, depends on the individual. So, you know, formulas are a little bit tricky because, you know, I've their 70s and they can get their heart rates up to, you know, 180s, no problem. Which is counterintuitive, you know, goes against the 220 minus your age. But also it assumes that you have a decent level of fat burning already. So I've tested clients where they do not have a crossover point, meaning that they're carbohydrate dependent even at rest. And there are a lot of factors that contribute to that. So it's difficult to be formulaic about it. However, if you did stick to a regimen of training at about, you know, 60%, meaning you don't go over the 60% of your predicted max or your true max, you know, if you do a test that gets you up to your max heart rate, and there are a lot of different tests for that too, you're going to be in a pretty good place to actually put a lot of this stuff into action. When I was competing in late 90s, early 2000, I was training with Mike Pig, who was a very accomplished triathlete, and I moved up to train with him. And he had been coached by a fellow named Phil Maffetone. And Phil Maffetone was a chiropractor and did a lot of applied kinesiology work and nutrition work. And he put out quite a lot of books. But with Mike, I was kind of converted to training on that paradigm, which was being very aerobic conscious, especially, you know, we were racing professionally as triathletes. You know, I was doing mostly Olympic distance. Mike was doing, you know, kind of a mixed bag of Ironmans and Olympic distance. But we did 180 minus your age, which was Phil Maffetone's, called it as your max aerobic function. And once every 3 months, you could do a 5-mile time trial at your 180 minus your age heart rate and note the pace. And the assumption was that at 180 minus your age was right about at that kind of crossover point into getting, you know, a little bit anaerobic.
You know, I'm very interested in this topic because as Sunny has pointed out to us, you know, this is a caloric deficit sport in ultra running. We're out there for, you know, 10 hours, 20 hours, and if we can only digest and process 300 calories an hour and we're burning 7 to 1,000 calories per hour, the only way to keep that up is through what you're discussing with us today is fat burning. So that mm-hmm. makes up the difference. Otherwise, we go through 300 calories and we sit down on the trail till we can get another 300 calories in this, and then we get back up and run again. So fat mm-hmm. burning is a big part and a big piece of success on the on your performance out there. So how is it that we can now increase and improve that fat burning capacity within our bodies? What do we do as runners?
How do we move that bell curve to the right?
Well, so first you have the metric, right? So you have your bell curve, you know where your max fat oxidation is, your max fat burning. And let's say, you know, again, we use that example. Let's say it's 120 to 130 beats per minute. Kind of what you need to do is stimulate that system. So you can train those metabolic pathways the same as you could a muscle. The same reason why you might do repeats or fartlek workouts, etc. You're training different systems within the body that allow you to improve and adapt.
So Tim, I like where this is going. I'm ready to learn how to burn my fat.
Okay, so
I'm going to listen intently.
So essentially, you target your intensity, and then it's all about continued stimulus. So, for example, if you do, you know, and I usually tell my clients who go through this process, and these are some are busy people who don't have heaps of time to exercise, and some have a lot of time to exercise. And I find that about six hours a week in that zone, we'll call it your metabolic efficiency zone or your max fat burning zone, you know, that's going to help you stimulate that fat metabolic system. So what we're doing is we're increasing the enzymes that allow you to break down fats to produce energy and also release fats more effectively from your stores so that that fat can be used as a fuel source. So if we say, okay, we're going to take the exercise, we're going to stimulate those fat-burning pathways through exercise. We're going to build the scaffolding for fat metabolism and make it better, make it more robust, while simultaneously eating in a way that allows you to improve those fat metabolic pathways. My point is you stimulate it with the exercise, and then you stimulate it with the nutrition. And that's where the great thing about this really comes together, because you have a pairing of your exercise intensity and your eating paradigm. So if you're exercising at lower intensities where we know you're already burning much less carbohydrate, okay, so if you kind of look at your fuel systems, I say it's akin to like a hybrid motor. You always need some petrol. You always need some gas. And then you want to be able to use that electric motor as best as possible because it produces less emissions. It burns cleaner. You're going to save your petrol so you don't have to stop and fill up all the time. So your glucose or your sugars that your body stores, that's your constant kindling. You cannot function without it. And if not, and if you're low on blood glucose, if any of you have ever bonked before, you know, that dizzy, nauseating, I'm going to die feeling, that's when blood sugar is pretty much super low. And your body makes up for that by breaking down more of the proteins that it stores in the muscles. So again, we want to avoid that. We want to make sure that that petrol tank is full and always feeding the electric motor. So coming back a step, if we're exercising where fat metabolism is very good, carbohydrate metabolism, we're kind of sparing more carbohydrate as we train. So now what we can do is do a nutrition intervention where we're not so carbohydrate dependent. You know, a lot of athletes will be on that 65% to 75% carbohydrate diet, which A, eliminates the amount of room you have for your essential fats. So we typically have too low of fats, which can affect you hormonally, and it's not so great for your anti-inflammatory systems. But also, we tend to have higher insulin levels as well. And when you have chronically elevated insulin levels, you're essentially shutting down a lot of that fat metabolism scaffolding and enzymes and things I was talking about earlier. So what you can do is, okay, I'm going to reduce the exercise intensity to where I'm mobilizing the most fat and sparing a lot of carbohydrate. So now I can shift into a nutrition plan where, you know, I can replace a lot of my grain heavy based carbohydrates, and I'll stress the word replace, with more nutrient dense carbohydrates like fruits and vegetables. So I can reduce a lot of the insulin effect of my day-to-day eating by replacing those carbohydrate heavy grains with nutrient heavy, fiber rich, good sources of carbohydrate in terms of nutrients. Cold climate fruits and vegetables and things, you know, beans and legumes as well.
Are you still keeping the same percentage of carbohydrates in your diet? That's the first question. And before I leave that, I want to say I'm glad you said that, because up to that point I was thinking, okay, if I want to train my metabolic efficiency in my body, what I was – I don't want to oversimplify this – I'm going to
run very slowly and go on an Atkins or South Beach diet. Mm-hmm. But that's not what you're saying.
No, that's not what I'm saying. You need to get those carbohydrates in, because even if, let's say you're burning 800 calories an hour and you're still burning a good chunk of that as fat calories, you know, let's say 500 fat calories, which is, you know, that'd be a lot, but just to make it simple.
Yeah.
If you're burning 500, well, you're still burning 300 calories of carbohydrate per hour, right? So if you're out on a 3-hour training run and you're not getting enough carbohydrate in your body, you're essentially going into that sort of depletive state where your body is going to start breaking down more proteins to supply that energy to you. Now that could work in some circumstances, maybe clinically, but you know, I wouldn't recommend it for an athlete. And that's what I've seen on occasion. You have to pair the exercise and the nutrition. Because some people, you know, they'll come in, we'll do the metabolic efficiency test, we'll spend an hour talking about what the plan is and how to execute it. And you know, I'd say 1 in 5 will come in and say, I did a 4-hour ride on Saturday and I totally bombed. Like, well, you know, did you keep it in your metabolic efficiency zone? Well, no, not the whole time, because I had to get up those hills. And oh, did you hydrate? Well, I had a bottle, but you know, it's all easy intensity, right? And, well, no. And then, you know, you get the people who say, well, I was just eating a lot of salami. Now, that won't help either. So the key here is you definitely need carbohydrates. They are super important. And the goal of this is to lay down the infrastructure so that we're not as carbohydrate dependent. And I found just in the last year and a half, I've done a lot of these tests. And I find that regardless of the level of the athlete, the age of the athlete, the gender of the athlete, fat burning could be better. And at the very least, people learn a lot going through this process based on, well, what's a metric, like what is low intensity? Because I guarantee if any of you said, hey, do an easy run, you'd probably be going well above where this metabolic zone is for actually being easy. Because we all have it in us to, we want to go fast, we want to train hard. And, you know, if we want to go the distance, you know, we're going to go long periods of time and, end up going outside of that zone, and then you can end up bonking and things like that. So to have this metric to actually, well, this is what it really feels like to work on my aerobic system. And now you have that sort of, you have that scope and you have that spectrum of true easy, medium, hard based on your metabolism, not based on the type A brainstem.
Hey, Tim, how long does it take to make this change? If I wanted to start tomorrow, when can I expect to see a measurable change, and what phase of training should I do this?
So the first question I would say, I've seen actually the first beta test and kind of application I did was on a 30-something, he was a type 1 diabetic, and I thought that'd be a great case study because we could track his blood glucose levels. He has a continuous blood glucose monitor.
Uh-huh.
And so he had great benefits in 3 weeks where his crossover point went from, he was about, again, this is for cycling, but again, you could just get a scope of the numbers. His crossover point went from like 70 watts to 150 watts.
Wow.
His blood glucose, his insulin dosing went down significantly. Based on what he told me, and he's a registered nurse, and he knows how much he's dosing. And his body fat went down 2%. I think that's kind of an extreme case. And again, he's really young, and he was spot on to the plan. So he was sending me text messages with pictures of bags of Doritos and things. And they just said, I hate you.
You know,
did a great job of compliance. But I would say, and what I usually do is, again, and going back to the literature of what it takes for people to go through these sort of, you know, biochemical and in terms of the cellular adaptations, you know, you look at that kind of 4 to 6 week range. So, you know, you might see an adaptation, let's say 3 to 6 weeks. And the best time to apply this sort of training is kind of when you need to do a base phase, or let's say if you have a really long season and you want to avoid that late season malaise, I'm going to have somebody just come back and do this sort of thing for just a month to restore. and retrain the system. You know, if they're doing a really long race plan in their year, whether they're, you know, whether they're runners or cyclists or triathletes, you know, and again, it depends on what level and how your race schedule's filled out to you in the year. But I think, so essentially 3 to 6 weeks for the adaptations, and then a good time to do it is kind of in your off season or as like a mid competitive season respite. You know, if you've got it really long, like if you're going up April to November, you could do something like that if you had like a little break in July. And you can still do this and maintain a lot of your snap just by doing a lot of strides and things. So
let's say that you have an athlete come in there and you find out where their crossover point is, mm-hmm. and you're training this person to move that crossover so that they're going at a higher intensity, burning fat at a higher intensity for a longer period of time.
Right.
That's the goal. Take us through a typical diet plan / training plan for them. How are you going to change their diet? Is it a flat out, you know, is there an introductory diet? How do you change their diet and how long does that take? And how do you change their fitness and how long does that take?
The bare bones of it is, you know, you test, and then I've been putting my clients on a 6-week program where, again, we shoot for that 6 hours minimum in the zone, and you spend very little time out of the zone.
Six hours
a minimum. Week. Yes, a week. Sorry, 6 hours okay. per week minimum. And then you try to cut down on grains, so your breads, your rice, your pastas, even if it's quinoa and all those nutrient-rich, complete protein-type grains, and you replace those with more fruits and vegetables. And more specifically, I say, you know, cold climate fruits. Fruits that kind of grow in the northern hemisphere, like berries, cherries, kiwi, even grapefruit is fairly low glycemic, essentially these low glycemic fruits. An easier way is to say, hey, if it grows in the northern hemisphere, it's probably low glycemic, you know, like peaches and plums and pears and apples, etc.
Let me interrupt you really quick. I want to get back to the 6 hours of low intensity training per week.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean there's 6 hours total training or 6 hours in that zone? Can they do 15 hours of training and six of that has to be in that low intensity? And the second part of that question is, do they do an hour at low intensity and that's their workout for the day, or do they do an hour of, can I go out for a 3-hour run, do an hour at low intensity, and then do two more at high intensity?
Yeah, so it's 6 hours in the zone minimum, and you look for good frequency. So you're getting in some stimulus every day aside from your rest day in the week. And then if you do more than 6 hours, you want to keep as much of that as possible in that metabolic efficiency zone. So
you don't want to go above that efficiency zone at all during the 6 weeks.
Correct. But there's some exceptions where what if, again, this is like a mid-season phase, or you're gearing up for a race, or quite honestly, it's people, they just want to stay inspired, and this can get a little boring. So I want to go on my group runs, you know, I want to go do, you know, X trail every Sunday. I mean, meet with friends, we run out in the Marin Headlands, and, you know, I can't do that run with my friends anymore because I can't keep my heart rate in this zone. So I'll just be like, all right, well, on that Sunday, go ahead and do the run. Don't even wear a heart rate monitor. Just go run with your friends, enjoy it, but understand that if you come out of that zone, you also come out of the metabolic efficiency kind of nutrition plan.
And does that put you back to zero?
I don't think it does. I've seen, you know, again, this is based on my experience. If you take, you know, 1 or 2 days where you kind of, you add a little high intensity and you do a good job of fueling both during and post exercise, kind of following those traditional paradigms of, you know, you take in about 20 to 40% of your expenditure, you're taking in your sugars, maybe you do a recovery drink in the 30 minutes post. Maybe you eat more grain-based foods in that, you know, 60 to 90 minute post session. And then for the rest of the day, okay, now you can go back into the metabolic efficiency plan. So you're essentially, you look at your entire day. Okay, well, my goal here is to be metabolic efficiency so I can really just lay down that system. That's my sole focus here. Well, I'm going to take out this little chunk to do a little speed work or go out and run with friends or do whatever. Okay, well, you pull out that chunk and you tack on another hour and a half. That's when you can eat your carbohydrate and go back to supplements and eat your grains. So you're essentially saying, well, you know, I'm going to eat metabolic efficiency before, and then, you know, once I've gone past the hour and a half post exercise.
All right, Tim.
So that would be the one or two exceptions.
I have a question about how long can you keep this? You know, I've gone out. I followed the diet. I've done all of the low intensity work. How long do I get to keep this benefit? Now that I'm going out and racing and going hard, mm-hmm. does it go away?
Does it shift back?
Shift back. I'm talking about does it shift? The old metabolic shift.
So you move that crossover point to where you're at a higher intensity, you can stay, you know, you're burning fat more efficiently.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Once you get back to that high intensity workout, you're getting closer to the races or whatever. Does that crossover move back?
That was my question, Scott.
Thanks. That's a good question.
Thank
Don.
You. Thank you, Scott.
There's a Skype echo. No, to answer your question, yeah, it'll reverse itself. It's kind of like if you lay in bed for 2 weeks, you'll atrophy. That system will not sustain, you know, its function if you don't use it. And so if you know, and I've seen that too, where you go on the plan and then all of a sudden you go off of it right back into your old habits that maybe were not so metabolically efficient friendly. It'll reverse. But the cool thing is I've seen with some people, it's not as good as it was when they did that second test, but it's better than their first one, even though they kind of went back to their old habits. So they still maintain some of that adaptation.
You know, as an athlete falls in and out of, you know, peak fitness level, and it's quicker to get back in there and restore your cardiovascular efficiency. You find the same thing with metabolic efficiency. You know, once you practice this, you're good at it. You've been in and out, and you've slid that point, you know, both to the left and the right of that bell curve. Do you see that this is something you can pick up quickly again, just because of the body's learned and adapted?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's that old study where they found, you know, somebody who didn't exercise, in five weeks they, you know, improved their aerobic capacity, and then all of a sudden for 3 weeks they were bedridden. They got all those adaptations back in 2 weeks instead of five. Mm. So there is some sort of memory there. And again, I can't say that scientifically. I have seen it anecdotally, but again, I think the key to this is it is a phase of your training, but you continue to stimulate that system and maintain it throughout the entire year.
Can you talk about the various products there are out on the market that, I don't know if force is the right word, but train your body or utilize fat stores rather than carbohydrate stores?
In terms of like supplements and things? Or?
Yeah, because I know they're out there.
Yeah, it depends. Like, because you want to use, I mean, obviously just anything, like real food can be a great way to do it. But if you look at products and what's easy for fueling, I know UCAN is a really good one, because it's a very low glycemic, and allows you to kind of break down sugars a little bit more slowly, which kind of, again, it promotes that fat burning and doesn't necessarily switch it off while you're using it. And so, you know, between UCAN and, what I recommend for people is, you know, when you go on a metabolic efficiency run, but, you know, let's say it's 2 to 2.5 hours and you're in your zone. Well, you need to hydrate. You need your electrolytes. And if you don't like the flavor of a quarter teaspoon of sea salt in your bottle, you could use things like Noons or have you heard of Noon tablets?
Oh, yeah. N-U-N.
And I actually, just for myself, those have those sugar alcohols, sorbitol. And I use that stuff every day. And I find that every now and then it just doesn't work with my stomach, which some sugar alcohols are kind of notorious for doing. So I've been switching over to using Scratch Labs came out with a product of daily hydration, which is very low sugar. It's like maybe 5 grams per serving, but it's all about electrolyte. So kind of what you want to do to promote that fat burning, and even if you're in a race situation where you're kind of at or, you know, just hovering around that metabolic deficiency zone, maybe you're just a little bit above it, you still need those sugars too, is hydrate without the calories and eat to get your sugars. Maybe an easier way to say that is, you know, hydrate for electrolyte and water, and then do the take in the sugars and the calories by eating. You know, so that's essentially switching. So you wouldn't drink something like, you know, Gatorade, which already has the sugars in it. That way, I think it's a little easier when hydration is paramount. So that way you can hydrate and you don't have to worry about over-sugaring or getting gastric distress or anything like that. That way you can kind of control it through eating.
Hey, Tim, on your and some of your endurance athletes, the Ironman distance, have you found when you have tested your group that more of the elite group, that they naturally have developed this metabolic efficiency rate that's just off the charts? It's like no wonder you can sustain, you know, 9 hours worth of work or 10 hours worth of work out there. You're just gifted genetically with this fat burning machine.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely, I've definitely seen that. And usually it just comes from the training alone. You know, you do years and years of that training. But again, I've also seen the opposite with, you know, and usually it's associated with some sort of fatigue or something. So if you have an endurance athlete who's very well trained and they're not really fat burning that well, you tend to have training issues. They usually get injuries a little bit more, or you know, they don't sleep very well. So I think there's a pretty close tie between, you know, a good healthy fat metabolism and the immune system as well. So I think in the cases when I haven't seen very good fat burning in those higher level athletes, they're kind of tired. Maybe even their blood lactate tests look a little weird. And then we say, hey, well, maybe we can get your fat burning to align with your lactate threshold. And now, you know, your race pace is a little bit better. And actually just need to tone it down a little bit and let's restart and build this fat burning. Those are the athletes that are just really tough and they can handle a lot of stress and training, and you can just hit them with a hammer and they'll come right back.
Yeah,
I think a combination of the two.
There's a lot of variables out there. I think that what makes a good endurance athlete, and we're on the trail side over here, but I'm sure it's very much the same over, you know, on the run, bike, swim, where there's people with just great cardiovascular efficiency, metabolic efficiency. Their fast twitch, slow twitch muscle distribution is just ideal, and on with the amount of elastic properties that their fascia may have, you know, throughout their body to store and release energy. I think there's a lot of things on that on the list, but learning how to train each one of those is very important. And I think I've overlooked the fat burning and how important it is. I know I need it out there, but if there's a way to manipulate it, change it, adjust it to my advantage, that's going to help me deep into the miles out there.
You've laid down a lot of information during this podcast. If people want to learn more, you know, you reference a book by Bob Sibahar called Metabolic Efficiency Training, Teaching the Body to Burn More Fat. They can also go to your website, which is endurancepTC.com, which is Endurance Performance Training Center. There's a lot of services that you offer. If someone the Endurance Performance Training Center is based out of Mill Valley, California, which is the North Bay above San Francisco. They can go there. If someone is on the other side of the country or other side of the world, we have a lot of international listeners. Can they take advantage of your services? Is there a way for them to take advantage of these services, or can you? How do they learn more?
I think one resource is, for example, if you're equipped with a bit of knowledge, you know, maybe do a little bit of reading on the web. Look at Bob's website and his books, and you could go to your local, if there is a local, university or college. They'll usually have an exercise science department that has a metabolic part. And if they're not already familiar with this type of test, Bob lays it out in his book. Mm-hmm. Again, there are scientific journals that you would have access to via Google that you could bring in and give it to the physiologist and say, hey, this metabolic efficiency, and you know, they could actually do the test and get the numbers, and then, you know, maybe consult with someone like Bob or me or anybody else who's been doing this, and work through a training program that works for them if they needed that. But you know, with what Bob's done with the literature, it's been very helpful for people. And I always, you know, say, hey, go read the book, because you'll get that much more information. The more you understand, the better. And if you don't have access to the lab, or maybe you don't want to spend the money to actually go into the lab and do the test, or for whatever the reason might be, I'd found that you know, just applying like Maffetone's formula of 180 minus your age, and using that as a benchmark, where you know, during a certain phase of training, you know, you don't go above that heart rate, and you know, you try to switch up your nutrition program. But again, you know, it's something that you always want to talk to a professional about it first, maybe make sure that you get your head around it, or just hire a coach to work you through it. So you can be somewhat formulaic about it, but if you really want to nail it to, you know, 5 or 10 beats per minute, or a pace or a speed, whether you're on a bike or whether you're running, you do your test on a treadmill, et cetera, then, you know, the testing is really great.
It's the way to go. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you very much for joining us. We've learned a lot from you. We appreciate your time. Go out and run.
Indeed.